Welcome to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Friday, June 19th and Saturday, June 20th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. The other 4th of July, what Juneteenth means to Black Fort Dodgers in the fight for equality. To some, Juneteenth is like Christmas. To others, it's like the 4th of July. But looking around Fort Dodge, you'd hardly know it was a holiday on most streets. To many Black and African Americans, Juneteenth is something bigger than a holiday. It's a recognition of where America came from and a reflection on how far it has to go. As Juneteenth passed on Friday, Black Americans, some of whom have lived their entire lives in Fort Dodge, said they're still fighting for basic recognition of their community's struggles and the bare minimum of humanity they're due. The annual holiday, every June 19th, commemorates the effective ending of slavery in the United States in 1865. That year, 2 years after President Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, news finally reached Galveston, Texas, notifying residents that the war had ended and the enslaved were now free. But to DeMarcus Carter of Fort Dodge, Juneteenth isn't about history. It's about the future and the present. What we're doing to achieve, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, he said. That truth is no longer self-evident. We can't say that now. We watched a man die. This year, Juneteenth takes on a unique light for Black Americans after nationwide protests rocked the nation following the Memorial Day killing of George Floyd, a Black man in Minneapolis police custody. Video capturing Floyd's final moments showed the arresting officer kneeling on his neck as he begged for his life for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. It was a moment when the reality of the Black experience in America started to gain mainstream traction as something with grave issues to be addressed, as Black Fort Dodgers say racism continues to persist, even 155 years after Juneteenth. In a world where Carter, originally from Mississippi, said he has to check his mirror when passing patrol cars to ensure he's not being followed, he said Juneteenth helps restore some of his humanity, a way to connect with parts of himself that felt lost. Carter, 33, only came to know what the holiday was about 7 years ago. To mother of two, Malia Bandu, Juneteenth is a moment of pride that gives her hope in humanity in a world where she fears for her growing boys. The holiday, which she said their family treats like Christmas, gives them something of their ancestors to celebrate and an understanding of why they can be who they are now, free. But even with their freedom, the ugly underbelly of racism continues to be a daily hindrance for Black Americans in their pursuit of happiness. The fear and obstacles she contends with are multiplied with a 9- and 5-year-old. No matter how I raise them, what background they have, what values they have, somebody's going to look at them and say, "That's a Black man right there," Bandu said. Unlike many parents, she's scared of the day her child will turn 18 and want to leave the house. Her oldest son, Kyron, now 9, struggles to understand why she doesn't want him to even be at the park by himself. Kyron regularly tells her he doesn't want to play outside, she said, because it will darken his caramel-toned skin. At school, Bandu said other children make it explicitly clear that her Black boys do not belong in their America in the current political climate. As an experienced, educated woman, Bandu said she has struggled to get job interviews before, simply because of the name listed at the top of her resume. "I didn't want them to grow up wondering, 'We're Black, but what does that mean?'" Bandu said. "I want them to be proud." Even if it's a small token, Juneteenth gives them that moment in an often dark reality. She hopes it helps, at least in part, move change forward. "It's one thing to say you don't understand the Black struggle, but I need you to make the changes so the movement has purpose," she said. Some say the holiday, historically celebrated since the 1800s, but revamped in the late 20th century, has gained more public recognition lately. Though some Fort Dodgers noted that the topic was never mentioned in their history books, they hope that more public awareness will bring greater weight to the holiday. "The public has taken more notice of it," said Sherry Washington, president of the Fort Dodge NAACP chapter. "That, for me, is a great thing." Though the recent celebrations in Pleasant Valley have sometimes been disrespected by white residents showing up with a political agenda, she said the community continues to push forward. it kind of shows us where we are as a people, and it also brings us to understanding that we have to do better to understand others. We really do, she said. It shows promise for America's potential to change, she said, because it showed that America was open to equality. But after watching an epidemic of killings of Black Americans in police custody over the years, people like her recognize that the road ahead is long, saying that the Floyd killing showed the community that they're still fighting for the bare minimum. Was it a lot to ask for him not to be killed? Washington asked. The ask is, respect my authority, Carter said. But how can I respect your authority when you don't respect my humanity? A descendant of enslaved Americans, his great-great-grandmother escaped South Carolina with her two sisters generations ago. Her grandmother was born during the height of the Jim Crow era. His mother was born in 1969 after the Civil Rights Act was passed. The child of a single mother, Carter grew up in the 90s watching commercials on television telling him he was statistically likely to end up in prison. Now he's a scientist living in his dream home. Now he would like to give a Juneteenth flag the height it deserves, with a simple moment on a flagpole or a chance for the average citizen to see what it is or what it means. Let's not just get together and hold up our phones with lights. Let's make change, he said, envisioning a day where Fort Dodge flies the freedom flag. But as he struggled to find the political capital to deliver on a meaningful, even if performative, event this year, he said Fort Dodge still has plenty of room for growth. Mayor Matt Bemrich declared June 19th Juneteenth Day in the city of Fort Dodge in honor of the spirit and freedom of African American pioneers and all African Americans in Fort Dodge. For me, it's like when America recognizes we were wrong. We can be better than this, Carter said. We should celebrate that mindset. Stop the violence. Juneteenth celebration will have clear message in Fort Dodge. A holiday which commemorates the freedom of African Americans from slavery will be celebrated in Fort Dodge with heavy hearts and mixed emotions after violence shook the Fort Dodge community on Tuesday when two bystanders were shot and killed in Pleasant Valley. A Juneteenth program will be held at 7 p.m. on Wednesday at City Square Park. And the message is one that connects the past with the present, according to Sherry Washington, president of the Pleasant Valley Awareness Committee. The focus this year for us is to really speak on the violent history of our past as well as our present, Washington said, and really just how far we have come together as people in our local community and also around the world. Stop the violence is our message. Racial tensions have escalated across the globe since the killing of George Floyd on May 25th, when a Minneapolis police officer kneeled on his neck for nearly 9 minutes. That officer, Derek Chauvin, has since been fired and charged with second-degree murder. Black Lives Matter protests have been held in thousands of communities in recent weeks. Some have been peaceful. In some major cities, the protests have turned violent, with people suffering injuries and buildings being damaged and looted. The events have caused cities to explore how police departments function and to what degree they might be modified in order to prevent certain conflicts from escalating. In Fort Dodge, a recent shooting claimed the lives of two men. Multiple shots were fired in the 900 block of 10th Avenue Southwest. Jamal Cox, 25, and Tyrone Cunningham, 47, were killed around 4:45 a.m. Marissa Andrews, 21, and Jane Bartram, 30, were injured. All of the bystanders except Bartram of Wesley were from Fort Dodge. No one has been arrested in connection to the crime. The act of violence has weighed heavy on many in the community, Washington said. The mood is very sad, Washington said. There's a roller coaster of emotions that are floating through the community, and with the most recent tragedies, that only heightened the sadness. Juneteenth marks 155 years since the Emancipation Proclamation reached Texas, freeing the last enslaved people in America more than 2 years after it was signed. The Juneteenth celebration will feature speakers Barb Crooks, a local educator, Angela Davis of Angela's Hair and More, Charles Clayton of Athletics for Education and Success, Zach Newsom, a local activist, and Colleen Peace, owner of the Wellness Project. Mayor Matt Bemrich will be the master of ceremonies. Rob Johnson will also speak and render a prayer. Washington will speak with words of encouragement. With Juneteenth, there is happiness, but yet there is sadness, Washington said. This is a unity for us to get together and examine who we are as people. It's not to finger point. It's not to bring any negativity, but it's also to speak truth. When you have your facts, your truth, your history, there's not much you can do to change that, but you can change how you look toward the future. What? Juneteenth, stop the violence. Where? City Square. When? 7 p.m. Wednesday, June 24th. Fort Dodge teen charged with attempted murder. Suspect previously adjudicated for same charge at age 13. A 17-year-old boy was arrested Friday afternoon for attempted murder in connection to an August 7th shooting in Pleasant Valley, Fort Dodge police say. Isaiah Mosley, 17, of Fort Dodge, was charged with attempted murder, intimidation with a dangerous weapon, going armed with intent, and possession of a firearm as a felon. He is being charged as an adult with the Class B, Class C, and two Class D felonies. Search warrant applications involving Mosley indicate that the shooting may have happened in the 1200 block of 10th Avenue Southwest. The Webster County Telecommunications Center received information of possible shots fired August 7th around 10:50 p.m. Police were given a general location of Olson Park in terms of where the shots may have been coming from. Officers were unable to locate evidence of shots fired that night. The following day, a report was made regarding shots being fired at an occupied residence in the Pleasant Valley neighborhood of Fort Dodge. Police determined that the incident was likely the same one referred to in calls the night before. No injuries were reported from the incident. The application also notes that Mosley was shot in both legs just 4 days before the incident. It's unclear if the two incidents are related. Mosley was first charged with attempted murder and going armed with intent in January 2017 for a crime that happened in November 2016 when he shot his uncle after what court documents say was a fight over half a blunt. A blunt is a hollowed-out cigar filled with marijuana. The victim was hospitalized in serious condition after the bullet was lodged near his lung. Juvenile court adjudicated him of the offenses, finding that he committed them following a trial. He was in the detention of the State School for Boys in Eldora from June 2017 to April 2019. Juvenile records note that criminal complaints against the teenager started when he was 7. Before Friday's charges, he had accumulated 19 others, including simple assault, disorderly conduct, assault while displaying a weapon, and attempted murder. Mosley is held on a $140,000 cash-only bond. He will make an initial appearance in Webster County Magistrate Court today at 9 a.m. Crime Stoppers reward keeps climbing, $7,000 for info on double homicide. Webster County Crime Stoppers announced on Friday it has received an additional $1,000 to go toward a reward for information on Tuesday's early morning shooting, which led to the death of 2 men and injured 2 women. The donation was made anonymously. The total reward now sits at $7,000. The reward is being offered for information leading to the identification, apprehension, and prosecution of anyone involved in the shooting, which occurred in the 900 block of 10th Avenue Southwest. Jamal Cox, 25, and Tyrone Cunningham, 47, were killed around 4:45 a.m. Marissa Andrews, 21, and Jane Bartram, 30, were injured. All of the bystanders except Bartram of Wesley were from Fort Dodge. Cox, found lying in the street, suffered a gunshot wound to the upper torso, Fort Dodge police reported. Shortly after finding the first 3, police found Cunningham unresponsive in a single vehicle crash at the intersection of South 15th Street and 6th Avenue South after he managed to flee the scene, shot in the leg. Both Cunningham and Cox were pronounced dead at the scenes. Andrews was in stable condition before being transferred to a Des Moines hospital. Bartram was treated at Unity Point Trinity Regional Medical Center before being released Tuesday. The initial $5,000 reward offered was funded by an anonymous donor long before the shooting happened, with this specific purpose in mind, said John Bruner, president of the Crime Stoppers Executive Committee. Bruner said that reward amounts are determined by partners at the Webster County Sheriff's Office, Fort Dodge Police Department, and the Webster County Attorney's Office. In this case, their recommendation was unanimous. Typically, he said a reward this high is volunteered by anonymous donors to solve cold cases. Because of their charter, Crime Stoppers is prohibited from offering a reward more than $1,000, but can act as a conduit for private citizens or businesses wishing to offer such a higher reward. Since 2001, Webster County Crime Stoppers has paid out $170,000 in rewards and made 1,800 arrests, thanks to collaboration between citizens and law enforcement. Anyone with information on Tuesday's shooting, including any surveillance videos, photographs, or video, should contact Webster County Crime Stoppers or the Fort Dodge Police Department. Tips can be provided anonymously to Webster County Crime Stoppers by calling 515-574-1444 or by texting LEC followed by the tip to 274-637. A system is in place to deliver rewards without disclosing identity. Getting ready. Fort Museum to open Wednesday. Orville Kinney was busy on Wednesday rebuilding the tongue to a chuck wagon at the Fort Museum in Frontier Village. It was hot and humid inside the shed where the wagons were. At 79, Kinney is very much active. He and fellow maintenance man Tony Hellman are responsible for a lot of the behind-the-scenes work that keeps the fort operating, according to Laura Crowell, manager of the Opera House and acting manager of the fort. "He's always out here doing something," Crowell said. The Fort Museum will open to the public on Wednesday. Whether it's restoring a wagon or fixing a chandelier at the Opera House, guests would be hard-pressed to visit the grounds of the fort and not see Kinney's handiwork. "At my age, I'm trying to quit," said Kinney, who has been working at the fort for the past 5 years. "I came in and started working on an old schoolhouse down on the end," Kinney said, "and it grew from there. He and another helper restored another chuck wagon a few years ago. "Made out of an old flare box," Kinney said, "took all the lumber out of it." Meanwhile, the Opera House has been hosting bingo nights and coin club meetings to bring in some added revenue. Graduation parties, weddings, and dances are typically held there also, and those events are the main income for the fort, according to Crowell, who said the fort does not receive city or county funding. Crowell and Terry Cox, a Fort Dodge Historical Foundation board member, have been sprucing up the property as well. They pressure washed the wood exterior of the Opera House and cleaned the flooring upstairs. When the fort opens, guests can walk through original buildings from the mid-1800s to the mid-1900s, including a one-room schoolhouse and an original 1850s log cabin. The fort's collection features thousands of artifacts, from military memorabilia to Native American art and tools. Fort Dodge postcards, a variety of colorful rocks, and other souvenirs are inside the trading post. A replica Cardiff Giant and William Williams, founder of Fort Dodge memorabilia, are other attractions at the museum. Crowell said a white schoolhouse should also open this year. "It's a 1950s schoolhouse," she said. "We have two now, 1850s and 1950s. "The jailhouse is a popular attraction for the children," Crowell said. "They love going in there," she said. A building with a large collection of pottery is also on display. Crowell, a native of Fort Dodge, has fond memories of the fort and Frontier Days. "We came out to Frontier Days every year," she said. "My kids always loved coming out. Had to come out and get our root beer every year and go through Buckskinner's camp at the fort. Growing up here, I always knew about the fort and coming out for Frontier Days. Like most people in Fort Dodge, I didn't realize it's always open." Crowell, who holds a bachelor's degree in art education, started managing the Opera House in 2017. "I wanted more people to know what's out here," she said. "I just didn't realize it's so big. There's a lot out here to get to know. It would take you a few days to get through everything." Madeline Servine works in the trading post, and Crowell said she often comes up with new ideas to bring excitement to the fort. "We gave a cool tour around Halloween," Crowell said. "She found creepy things and walked around and put it in candlelight. We might do something like that again." "For most part, though, the fort relies heavily on volunteers," Crowell said. "The last few years have been hard," she said. "We can always use volunteers." What? Fort Museum in Frontier Village opening Wednesday. Where? One Museum Road. New hours, from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Wednesday through Sunday. Cost, $10 for adults, $5 for children, and children 5 and under get in free. to protect and serve Chris Wieland, patrolman, Fort Dodge Police Department. Question: how long have you been in law enforcement? Answer: I spent 10 years as a military police officer, and this July 2020 marks my 20th year as a civilian law enforcement officer. Question: what other law enforcement positions and departments have you served in? Answer: I first was in law enforcement when I joined the Army in March 1992 as a military police officer, which I stayed with until May 2002 before switching to field artillery. In July 2000, I was hired as a police officer in Sioux City. I've been an officer in Britt and Dayton. Question: what's an interesting fact about you that some might not know? Answer: I enjoy classical music when I want things to calm down. Question: what's the most memorable incident you've responded to? Answer: when I was stationed in Germany, I responded to a vehicle rollover. The parents were able to get out okay, and I had to do CPR on an 8-year-old girl that never made it. I still see her today. Question: what's the best part of your day? Answer: when I get to go home to my family. Question: what gives you the most satisfaction in your job? Answer: knowing that I did my best to take care of the situations assigned to me. Question: what's the toughest part about your job? Answer: not knowing what will happen when I get to a call. Will everything be okay, or will something keep me from getting home to my family? Change is coming. New owner of mall seeks zoning switch as it readies development. The new owner of Crossroads Mall in Fort Dodge appears to be moving closer to redeveloping the site. Crossroads Plaza Development, LLC of Ankeny, is asking city officials to change the zoning designation of the property. The requested change would then allow the company to move forward with converting the site into an area with multiple uses, including stores, offices, apartments, a gas station, a medical facility, and a hotel. The plans also call for a 10,000-square-foot green space near the middle of the complex. The site has been renamed Corridor Plaza. The new owners bought the site from Namdar Realty Group, Mason Asset Management, and CH Capital, all of Great Neck, New York, in a roughly $3.3 million deal that closed in March. When the deal was announced, Ben Garrett, development director of DCI Group, one of the firms that makes up Corridor Plaza Development, said, "We want to make this the focal point of the community for retail." Mayor Matt Bemrich previously described the company's plan as a catalyst project. "I think this will be the same kind of catalyst for changing retail culture that the original mall was when it opened," he said. "This will bring back the regional hub draw that Fort Dodge has traditionally had." Corridor Plaza Development plans to tear down the vacant wings of the mall that once housed Yonkers and JCPenney. The former Sears store was demolished in November 2019. It also announced plans to construct a new retail building this year to house 4 to 6 stores. A new medical facility is planned for the north side of the property along First Avenue South. The company has asked the city government to change the zoning designation of the site from shopping center commercial to planned development. The city's Plan and Zoning Commission will consider that request when it meets at 4 p.m. Tuesday in the Municipal Building, 819 First Avenue South. That commission's decision will be a recommendation forwarded to the City Council, which will have the final say. New legislation would split CSS. Webster County could start its own mental health region soon. Mental health policy changes tacked onto a budget bill could soon allow Webster County to divorce County Social Services, or CSS, after years of tension. House File 2643, the latest budget for the Department of Health and Human Services, which passed the Iowa House of Representatives 51-41 in a late Saturday night session, would split County Social Services into two regions. With 22 counties, the mental health region is twice the size of Central Iowa Community Services, the next largest mental health and disability services region in the state. Iowa has 14 regions. It could be a great opportunity for our area and a great opportunity for local providers, Webster County Supervisor Mark Campbell said. Specifically, it would allow the region to gain badly needed inpatient beds, subacute care, and full access centers. The budget bill went to the governor's desk after State Representative Ann Meyer's original bill that would allow new mental health regions to be formed, introduced in February, failed to get to the floor for a vote. Consternation from committee and subcommittee members, among others, was focused on the possibility that new regions could be non-contiguous, she said. Much of that concern was derived from windshield time with long drives for services. But for a lot of services, people in CSS were already in the car driving for an hour or two, said Meyer, a Republican from Fort Dodge. Currently, a county can leave for another region, but is not able to form a new region of its own. New legislation awaiting Reynolds' signature would allow a new region to be formed with a population of 50,000 and at least one city with a population of 24,000. New rules would also allow a departing county to take its reserve funds with it. Under current rules, if Webster County wanted to leave for another mental health region, it would lose $1.6 million in reserves that are used to tide it over from year to year before taxes are paid. Perhaps just as importantly, it would allow the state legislature to audit a region. Many of Webster County's frustrations with CSS have boiled over publicly on more than one occasion, with county supervisors often expressing exasperation over an inability to get county-specific statistics showing how many residents are being served and the cost per resident. At $1.4 million annually, Webster County is the third largest funder of the 22-county system. Blackhawk County, home to the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Metro, is the largest. Requests were often met with responses indicating the region was unable to break their statistics down into county-specific numbers. In their last October encounter with CSS's CEO, Bob Lincoln, supervisors grilled the head on the region's lack of transparency. "How many times do we have to ask for the numbers?" said Supervisor Keith Denklaw in October, noting his requests over 5 years. "I've gotten an excuse every year, and you're standing there giving me another excuse. I can't levy for this stuff if I don't have any numbers or any facts." "It's unproductive for us to generate numbers for member counties," Lincoln responded, in part before moving on with this presentation on CSS expansions. After being told that contracts were in place for a mental health access center, which Meyer said was dangled in front of the county to prevent it from leaving the region sooner, Campbell said that CSS was unable to produce copies of the contracts. "If everybody was getting equal services, it would be workable," Campbell said. In February, supervisors submitted a Freedom of Information Act request to CSS to get the information they needed, an act usually reserved for journalists petitioning government entities for access to documents or information. The request was acknowledged, but Webster County is still without the numbers it needs. Lincoln resigned from CSS early this week after the legislation including the ability to audit regions passed. "We wanted to know where our citizens' tax dollars were going and, by tracking this data, opportunities for improvement," said Supervisor Nikki Conrad. "Knowing whether money is being used for acute care or substance abuse treatment, for example, can inform decisions." Meyer noted that a lot of Webster County funding was going to Waterloo without benefiting the western quadrant of the region. In the new legislative scheme, counties east of and including Cerro Gordo County would continue to be called CSS. Worth, Winnebago, and Kossuth counties have already planned to join Northwest Iowa Care Connection to their west. Webster County could potentially join Central Iowa Community Services, Rolling Hills Community Services, or North Iowa Care Connection if it decides not to form its own region. The viability of joining Northwest Iowa Care Connection would depend on where Pocahontas County decides to go. Meyer said the legislation will finally allow regions to work out the kinks in the mental health and disability service region model about 10 years after it was created, with no major changes since. "I feel like if you put something into law and it's brand new, somewhere down the line we'll see issues and need to work out the kinks," she said. "That's what this is doing." She is hopeful Governor Kim Reynolds will sign the bill soon. "There's no indication she's not going to sign it," she said after speaking with the governor's staff Wednesday. You are listening to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Friday, June 19th and Saturday, June 20th, 2020 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Donald Belletti, No services are planned at this time for Donald Belletti, 53, of Fort Dodge. Don died Tuesday, June 17th. Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services are in charge of arrangements. Brenda Shipman. Brenda Shipman, 54, of Fort Dodge, died Friday, June 19th at Trinity Regional Medical Center. Services are pending with Loffersweiler Sievers Funeral Home. Jamal S. Cox. Jamal S. Cox, 25, of Fort Dodge, passed away Tuesday, June 16th. Funeral services will be 11 a.m. Friday, June 26th at Loffersweiler Sievers Funeral Home. A visitation will be 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday at the funeral home. Patricia A. Foley. Patricia A. Foley, 84, passed away on Thursday, June 18th at St. Anthony Regional Hospital in Carroll. There will be a private family service. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Palmer Swank Funeral Home is serving the family. Doris Weiss Heitzusen. Doris Weiss Heitzusen, age 97, passed away peacefully on Monday, June 8th at the Keystone Nursing Care Center. She is survived by her children, Jolene Allers and spouse Terry of Fort Dodge, Cheryl Owen and spouse Dennis of Anamosa, Keith Heitzusen of Luzerne, 4 grandchildren and 6 great-grandchildren. The funeral service was on June 11th at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Luzerne. Sandra Malloy. Sandra Sandy Malloy, 73, passed away peacefully with family by her side on June 17th at Parkwood Meadows Assisted Living in Idaho Falls, Idaho. A lifelong Iowa native, she moved to Idaho Falls after an illness in 2018 to be closer to her immediate family. Sandy was a registered nurse at Friendship Haven in Fort Dodge for many years before retiring in 2013. She was artistically talented and had many hobbies, including photography, painting, engraving, and music. Her family and friends will miss her wit and humor. She was preceded in death by her husband, Dick, and is survived by her son, Joe Malloy, and spouse, Julie, in Idaho Falls, 3 grandchildren, and 3 great-grandchildren. A family service will be held at North Lawn Cemetery in Fort Dodge. Michael S. Everhard. Michael S. Everhard, 65, of Fonda, died Thursday, June 18th, at Unity Point Trinity Regional Medical Center. A service honoring Michael's life will be 10 a.m. Friday, June 26th, at the Gunderson Funeral Chapel. Military honors will be presented by VFW Post number 1856. Visitation is 5 to 8 p.m. Thursday at Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services. Memorials may be directed to the discretion of the family. Michael is survived by his children, Michael A. Everhard and spouse Jamie of Des Moines, Amy Gardner and spouse Jonathan of Newton, Stephen Everhard of Fonda, 18 grandchildren, 5 great-grandchildren, and a sister, Janet Hamilton and spouse Bruce of Sioux Falls, South Dakota. He was preceded in death by his parents and his brother George. Michael Stephen Everhard, the son of Raymond and Shelda Day Everhard, was born March 31st, 1955 in Fort Dodge. He was reared and educated in Fort Dodge, Barnum, and Humboldt, and attended Humboldt High School. Michael served in the United States Navy. He was stationed in San Diego, served in Vietnam and Guam, and also had tours in India and Cambodia. He was a truck driver for a while and worked for IBP, and later Tyson Foods in Storm Lake and Waterloo for 40 years. Michael also started an auto repair business with his son, Stephen. Michael was an avid fan of the Minnesota Vikings, enjoyed fishing, and loved to have a wrench in his hands to help make things better. Michael greatly treasured his family and would do anything for them. Rita Beshe. Rita Mary Beshe, 90, of Fort Dodge, passed away Tuesday, June 16th. A mass of Christian burial will be 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, June 23rd, at Corpus Christi Church, with Monsignor Kevin McCoy officiating. Burial will follow in Corpus Christi Cemetery. A visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Monday at Loffersweiler Funeral Home. Rita is survived by her children, Lorraine Dreyer and spouse Roger of Aurelia, Janine Denklau of Fort Dodge, Mark Beshe of Fort Dodge, David Beshe and spouse Feng Ming of Newton, and Edward Beshe of Fort Dodge. 10 grandchildren, 14 great-grandchildren, and siblings Sister Teresa Rowling, Helena Ermiter, and Bernard Rowling and spouse Connie, brother-in-law Eugene Yetmar, and sisters-in-law Alice, Deb, and Marlene. She was preceded in death by her parents, Peter and Elizabeth Mary Schmidt Rowling, husband Wayne Beshe in 2002, grandsons Jacob Dreyer and Alex Detklau, and siblings Frank, Bernadette, James, Michael, Patrick, Marcella, Charles, John, Joseph, Dennis, and Dorothy. Sisters-in-law Joan, Dorothy, Marion, Velma, and Helen, and brothers-in-law Jerry Ermiter and Dennis Eckerman. Rita Mary Rowling was born on August 9, 1929 in Armstrong. She was raised and educated in Bancroft. She graduated from St. John's High School and then attended St. Joseph Mercy School of Nursing. She was later employed at Mercy and later Trinity Regional Hospital as one of the first ICU nurses. She retired in 1994 after working there for more than 30 years. In 1953, she was united in marriage to Wayne Beshe. They made their home in Fort Dodge, eventually working together to build a house just south of town. She was a member of Holy Trinity Parish. The family would like to thank the staff of Unity Point Home Care, Villa Care, and Unity Point Hospice for their exceptional care. Memorials may be left to the discretion of the family. Brent Ben Newton. Brent Ben Newton, 50, of Fort Dodge, passed away Wednesday, May 13th at Trinity Regional Medical Center. A celebration of life will be 2 to 5 p.m. Saturday, June 27th at Laufersweiler Siebers Funeral Home. A prayer service will conclude the service at 5 p.m. at the funeral home. Ben is survived by his wife of 33 years, Jackie, daughter Kelly Culver, grandsons Jabek Dunbar and Joseph Joey Culver Jr., all of Fort Dodge. Brent Nathan Newton was born November 2, 1969 in Winnebago, Nebraska. He graduated from Fort Dodge Senior High School in 1988. On December 19, 1987, he was united in marriage to Jackie. On April 13, 1988, they welcomed daughter Kelly into the world. Ben worked at various jobs throughout the years, including Cold Storage, Americold, Friendship Haven, and Ellen's as a nurse's aide, Hardee's, McDonald's, Burger King, His and Hers Miniature Golf, and Chesterfield's Lounge. Ben also loved to volunteer his time around his community. He volunteered with the Cub Scouts for 4 years as the Cub Master Leader. He also volunteered at the Blandon Art Museum and Rogers Rangers. He often volunteered during the Frontier Days, where he would work with Dave Parker and Colonel Bill Ryan. A former local artist, Sumner Heeman, often used Ben as subject matter in his drawings. Ben enjoyed throwing darts on leagues. He also enjoyed the delicate process of making Indian beadwork. Ben was very proud of his Native American heritage. Ben was known for being organized. He loved spending his free time playing board games and cards with his friends and family. Ben began having health problems in late 2004 and had to start dialysis weekly for the next 16 years. He was preceded in death by his parents, Charles and Lois Stamper Kravacek, granddaughter Talacia Culver, in-laws Matthew and Letha Peters. Ben was a people person and a great friend to many. His big heart and great smile will be missed dearly. Memorials may be left to the discretion of the family. Police investigate shooting in Loomis Park. Fort Dodge police are investigating a shooting between two groups Wednesday night at Loomis Park. Responding to reports of shots fired around 10:15 p.m., officers said they found evidence of the shooting as they examined Loomis Park, in addition to witnesses who heard what may have been shots. A vehicle that was shot at was later discovered near the park at the intersection of 15th Avenue North and North 8th Street with damage from gunfire. No one was injured at Loomis Park, though a 17-year-old girl occupying the vehicle during the shooting had minor injuries from breaking glass. Police said in a statement Thursday morning that initial information indicated a vehicle was fleeing the area as several shots were fired. They now believe that two groups of people were in the park when one group began firing at the other, which was driving away. We believe this is an isolated incident among those involved and have no information indicating any relation to the homicide investigation currently taking place, said Captain Ryan Grunberg, public information officer, in a press release referring to Tuesday's double homicide in the 900 block of 10th Avenue Southwest. Police encourage anyone with information to come forward. The Fort Dodge Police Department can be reached at 515-573-2323. Tips can be provided anonymously to Webster County Crime Stoppers by calling 515-574-1444 or by texting LEC followed by the tip to 274-637. Humboldt School Board awards $1.2 million parking lot bid. A Fort Dodge construction company was awarded a nearly $1.2 million contract from the Humboldt Community School District on Monday evening. Jensen Builders Limited was awarded the contract for the Humboldt High School parking lot replacement project for $1,194,000. Interim Superintendent Mike Sherwood said the replacement project of the school's west side parking lot, where most students park, was much needed. "There was some deterioration," he said. "We're seeing a lot of potholes and deterioration of the asphalt." Sherwood said he wasn't sure on the age of the parking lot, but said it had served the district well and it was time for an upgrade. Jensen Builders will begin work on the project on Monday and are scheduled to have the parking lot finished by August 14th, before the school year begins. During the Monday meeting, the Humboldt Community School District Board of Education also approved a $12,580 purchase of safety equipment for football, softball, and baseball. Equipment includes helmets, shoulder pads, batting helmets, and catcher's equipment. Sherwood said athletic safety equipment can be paid for through the district's general fund through approval by the school board. In other business, the school board approved a bid for the district to purchase 500 new Chromebooks along with other technology items from Sterling Computers and CWG for $162,328.53. The 500 Chromebooks will be distributed to the district's 5th and 9th graders in the fall. The bid also included purchasing management licenses, carrying cases, charging carts, 47 laptops, and 30 desktop computers. "I think the challenge with COVID-19 is trying to get those orders in and get them here in a timely fashion for the start of the school year and being prepared for whatever learning model the district has to implement next fall," Sherwood said. News brief: Webster County has 111 COVID-19 cases. Webster County ended at 111 cases Friday, up 3 from Thursday, according to Webster County Public Health. The cases fall into the following age categories: child age 0 to 17, 8; adult age 18 to 40, 59; middle-aged adult age 41 to 60, 29; older adult age 61 to 80, 14; elderly adult age 81 plus, 1. 85 of the cases, 77%, have recovered and been released from public health isolation. News brief: road closure announced on 28th Avenue North. Weather permitting, beginning Monday for 2 weeks or until work is completed, traffic on 28th Avenue North between Williams Drive and North 13th Street will be closed to through traffic until work is completed for concrete patching repairs. Detours will be in place. Motorists are urged to reduce speed and use caution in the area. Please use alternate routes if possible. News brief: Fort Dodge Utility Billing Office closed on Tuesday. The City of Fort Dodge Treasurer's Office and Utility Billing Office will be closed for ongoing construction on Tuesday. All other offices at the Municipal Building, 819 First Avenue South, will be open by appointment. News brief: Otho July 4th Parade will go on. Otho's annual 4th of July Parade and fireworks show are still set to happen on Independence Day, according to City Clerk Sherry Simmons. "We're still doing our parade, but with social distancing," she said. "No candy is being thrown." The parade will kick off at 1:30 p.m. on July 4th. Because of the COVID-19 pandemic, the Otho Betterment Committee has decided to cancel the kids' games and activities usually held in the city park. The Otho Fire Department has also decided to cancel its pancake breakfast. The fireworks show will begin at dusk on July 4th. News brief, Wright County hits 300 COVID-19 cases. Wright County hit 300 COVID-19 cases Thursday, less than 2 weeks after it surpassed 200 cases. It had 310 cases by the end of Thursday. Webster County added 5 new cases, totaling 108 Thursday. Hamilton County went from 124 Tuesday to 140 Thursday as it continues to outpace Webster County. Webster County continues to have the highest percentage of recovered patients as the infections continue to grow in the region. Recoveries in each county are as follows: Webster 81 or 77%, Hamilton 71 or 50%, Wright 116 or 37%. Rain washes out softball game but not player spirits. The St. Edmund and North Union softball game was postponed after inclement weather hit Rogers Park on Thursday evening. The Warriors led the contest 4-3 heading into the top half of the fourth inning. North Union put all 4 of its runs on the board in the first frame. Hope Steinberg led off the contest with a double, and Cassie Beadle followed with a single. Olivia Von Bank and Maggie Engelby had RBI doubles. Emily Meyer had an RBI sack bunt, and the Warriors also scored on a wild pitch. For the Gales, pitcher Ella Vratney had 2 RBIs. She had a sacrifice fly and an RBI single. Callie Henning had a double and scored 2 runs. Josie Timmerman was 2-for-2 with a run scored. A decision on if the game will be finished has not been made yet. The Gales will play at North Union on July 2nd for an already scheduled game. Dodgers make quick work of Esterville LC. Senior Schnetzer drives in 6. The top-ranked Class 5A Fort Dodge softball team didn't like what happened on Wednesday at Johnston, and Esterville Lincoln Central paid for it on Thursday afternoon at Rogers Park. The Dodgers cruised to a 7-2 victory against the third-ranked Dragons on the road the day before, but fell 5-3 in the nightcap after leading early. Less than 24 hours later, it was a different story as Fort Dodge, 3-1 overall, opened the floodgates early with a 7-0 lead before winning by a 13-3 margin in 6 innings. The Dodgers will start the season with 9 games in the first week. They will travel to Urbandale on Friday, then host the one-day Fort Dodge Invitational at Rogers Park. The Dodgers open with second-ranked Newell Fonda, 1A. The Mustangs are coached by former Fort Dodge standout Courtney Von Darrow on Saturday morning. We go from practicing on our own to having to be ready in 2 weeks and then a busy week to start the season, said Fort Dodge head coach Andy Adams. That split at Johnston took some wind out of us, but we bounced back. We were playing hungry and excited on Thursday. We are going to get every team's best shot. Fort Dodge plated 7 runs in the first 2 innings on 7 hits, and 4 of them went for extra bases as they took their frustrations out on the ELC, which is 2-1. I like to see my kids get mad, Adams said. It proves they care. They know they can still get and do better. Senior Logan Schnetzer had a strong day at the plate for the Dodgers, going 3-for-3 with 6 runs batted in, giving her 10 already on the season. The first baseman started the Dodgers off with a 2-run single in the 4th inning. In the 2nd, she hit her 2nd home run of the season, driving in Tristan Doster. Schnetzer also added a sacrifice fly and an RBI double in the 6th. Jalen Adams and Doster were both 3-for-4 with an RBI each. Adams scored 4 times and Doster twice. Doster had 2 doubles. Adams and Doster had back-to-back RBI doubles in the 2nd inning. Martine Lowry each had 2 hits and drove in 2 runs. Tori Bennett, Haley Mills, and Maya Davis also drove in runs. Adams, 3-1, picked up the win, going 3 innings and allowing no hits. She struck out 8 batters and walked 0. Haley Wills also pitched the final 3 frames, allowing 2 hits and 2 runs. Sophia Klinger, Bennett, and Lowry all had stolen bases. Assistant coach Molly Mathis mentioned at Johnston at how they were taking hacks at the ball, Adams said. We have been reading the situation and trying to put the ball where it needs to be instead. With 2 outs, we have to do a better job of putting the ball in play. The Dodgers will play a doubleheader at Urbandale on Friday. Off and running, Wildcats continue their early season surge. The second-ranked Class 3A Humboldt softball squad continued its early winning ways on Friday with a 15-5 triumph over St. Edmund. The Wildcats, 3-0 overall, 2-0 in the North Central Conference, plated 6 runs in the first inning and 7 more in the second to defeat the Gales for the second time this week. St. Edmund did take a 2-0 lead early and plated 3 more runs in the fourth, but it wasn't enough. We only had 2 hits against All-State senior Wildcat pitcher Ellie Jacobson the first time around on Monday, so it was good to see the offense picking up some momentum again on Friday, Gale head coach Bill Sherbron said. We showed our youth early on, not making some of the plays we should have and falling behind more. It's difficult to play catch-up against a team like that. Our goal is to continue to get better each game. We did that with our bats last night. Alexis Hansen was 3-for-3 with 3 runs scored and 3 RBIs for Humboldt. Carly Thompson went 3-for-4 and Maddie Lang homered. Jacobson and Lang had 2 hits apiece. Jacobson struck out 9 in the victory. Callie Henning was 2-for-2 at the plate to lead St. Edmund, and catcher Casey Krutoff went deep. The Wildcats defeated the Gales earlier this week, 11-0. The Gales returned to action on Monday at Algona. The Wildcats are back on the diamond Monday as well, visiting Hampton Dumont. Top-ranked Dodgers sweep at Urbandale. 9 more RBIs for Schnetzer as FDSH plates 25. Logan Schnetzer is producing at a whole new level during the early stages of her senior season for the top-ranked Class 5A Fort Dodge softball team. The Dodgers' slugging first baseman drove in 9 more runs on Friday during a doubleheader sweep at Urbandale, as visiting FDSH ran away with 13-0 and 12-4 victories to improve to 5-1 as part of a busy first week of the season. Schnetzer went 3-for-4 in both games, raising her average to .684, 13-for-19 this year. She's driven in 19 runs in 6 contests and gone deep 3 times. Logan is just on fire, FDSH head coach Andy Adams said. I'm not really sure how you should pitch to her right now as an opposing team. I'm just glad she's on our side and we don't have to figure it out. She's worked incredibly hard over the last 4-plus years to get to this point, and it's great to see her mature into this leadership role. It's not just what she's doing on the field, but how she's handling herself in the dugout and with her teammates. We call her Mother Lo. Schnetzer has now upped her career home run total to 28 and her RBI count to 140. She is in her 4th season as a starter. This year, I'm 100% focused at the plate, said Schnetzer, an Iowa Central Community College recruit. I have gotten my momentum and swing back from off-season practice. Just touching up some minor mistakes with my dad, Dale, has really helped. I'm just trying to go out hard with my teammates for my senior season. The Dodgers were relentless at the plate on Friday, banging out 25 runs and 28 hits. Junior Tristan Doster was 2-for-3 with 2 runs scored and 4 RBIs in Game 1, then went 2-for-3 with 4 runs and 2 RBIs in the second contest. Doster also cleared the fence once. She had to leave in the middle of the second game after getting cleated while playing third base. Sophomore Jalen Adams was 4-for-8 in the twin bill with 4 runs and 3 driven in. Sophomore Tori Bennett scored 7 times. We were productive up and down the lineup, Adams said. Tori was phenomenal. Maya Davis, Martine Lowry, and Malia Lowry all did some great things. Tristan just continues to excel. She's been much more patient at the plate than she's ever been, which makes her that much more dangerous. There's a maturity to her now as an upperclassman in her approach. Adams twirled a one-hit gem in the opener with 7 strikeouts. Sophomore Haley Wills earned the complete game victory in the nightcap. The Jayhawks were 4-0 with 4 lopsided victories to open the year over Des Moines Hoover and North heading into the doubleheader. Fort Dodge returns to action on Saturday morning, weather permitting, in the FDSH Invitational at Rogers Park. The Dodgers are scheduled to face No. 2 Class 1A Newell Fonda at 9 a.m., followed by games against Winterset at 11 a.m. and Harlan at 2:15 p.m. on Diamond 1. Fort Dodge knocks off No. 1 Jayhawks. Dodger baseball squad escapes with wild 11-10 nightcap triumph. The final 3 outs are always the hardest to get in baseball, especially when a team is facing the defending state champions and the top-ranked squad in Class 4A. Things got interesting late for the Fort Dodge baseball squad at Urbandale on Friday, but the Dodgers found a way and hung on to score an 11-10 victory in the nightcap of a CIML doubleheader. Head coach Blake Utley's squad saw an 11-4 lead all but disappear in the bottom of the seventh inning before Easton Cone picked off a Jayhawk pinch runner for the final out to seal what wound up being a dramatic one-run win. "It's been a while since we've gotten one of these of this magnitude," Utley said. "I think almost all of our guys would admit that it was tense out there. It was nice to have that cushion to work with, and you have to give credit to Urbandale for battling back. They're the champs for a reason. They expect to win no matter what the score is or how late it is in the ballgame. This is just a huge boost of confidence for our program. It was awesome to see them enjoying it because they've worked really hard and there's a lot of great chemistry in this group. Those last three outs are tough to get, but we found a way to persevere." The Dodgers, 1-3 overall, plated 5 runs in the second inning and 3 more in the third to erase an early 2-0 deficit. A third run sixth made it 11-3 before the Jayhawks, 3-1, started to chip away at the deficit. Sophomore pitchers Carson Peterson and Jace Ulrich combined to allow just 3 runs through the first 6 innings of work. "Carson and Jace really battled," Utley said. "Carson pitched his tail off, and Jace did an excellent job in relief up until running into some trouble in the seventh. Easton came in and closed it out like a senior should. We have confidence in him." "Our pitchers weren't necessarily overpowering, but they found a way, and the defense really backed them up. The Dodgers didn't commit a single error in the nightcap." Junior Sawyer Springer drove in 4 runs and had a double. Senior Mason Bockhoven was 2-for-4 with a pair of runs scored. Cone drove in a pair. "We weren't completely surprised we successfully executed the pickoff play at the end," Utley said. "We figured they would try and get the kid into scoring position with a stolen base as the potential tying run. We caught him leaning. That was all assistant coach Nick Vinson, injured starting catcher Sean Halligan, Easton, and Jace." Senior Nick Bice scored 3 runs in the victory, and classmate Dylan Zimmerman came home twice. Nelson Cone had 2 walks, a single, a run scored, and an RBI. "We decided to go back a little more to our small ball strategy of bunting and forcing the defense to make plays," Utley said. "That's kind of old school Dodger baseball. It got some things going for us, and you could see the confidence building." Tyler Schreier and a few of the others laid down some outstanding bunts. The guys are getting their momentum and timing back. Urbandale took the opener 12-1 in 5 innings. The Jayhawks scored 4 times in the first inning and added 6 more in the second. Nelson Cone drove in Bice, who had Fort Dodge's only hit. The Dodgers returned to action on Monday at Ottumwa. And that does it for today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Friday, June 19th and Saturday, June 20th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.